Welcome back to Two Pints in the Corner with myself, Tony Raine, Dinky Dawson, legendary sound guy from the channel. We're here with Tim Miller, film critic, music critic, and all-round good guy. And special guest today, John Farrell, who was on the Boston scene all through the 80s and a part of the channel with Dinky and I, and ex-Berkeley student, and worked the Boston scene all through the 80s. So he's going to give us his take on the channel and what it meant to him and the bands that were working the scene at the time.
The bands that John was in, he had a band that he came out January 1987 to play and open for a guy called James Brown.
That's right.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. John's got a good story. Well, we start with that story.
Let's start with that.
Okay.
Tell us about your James Brown experience, John.
All right, so... We were opening for James Brown, and we went in to do the sound check, and everybody was really excited about the whole thing. We were like really looking forward to seeing James Brown and probably getting to meet him afterwards, you know. So it was like it was a huge, huge deal for us. Well, me especially. So anyway, we went in and we did the sound check. The James Brown band are doing the sound check, and it was absolutely incredible. He wasn't there, it was just the band doing the sound check. And so then we went up and we did our sound check and everything was pretty good. We came back and the place was packed. So it was just a really great gig. So we do our set, we get off, and we're in the dressing room, and we're waiting, for James Brown. So the next thing, the band go on and they do a couple of numbers before he. So still knows, we can't see him anywhere. And I'm backstage at this point. The door is open, at the back of the channel.
The loading doors.
So the next thing, the band is playing, the door is open, in walks James Brown, and it was like, wow. Right onto the stage and did an absolutely incredible show. I mean, it was just absolutely amazing. And he gets off, walks back out the door into his limo, and hops on his plane and goes back to Georgia. Nobody got to say hi, nothing. It was nothing. It was like,
wow.
So apparently, that's what he used to do at that point in time.
He was
flying, literally flying to the gigs and walking on, walking off.
There's a lot of them still, do you know? It's so, a bit like the Commitments, huh?
It was, oh,
yeah. It doesn't show up at the end of the movie.
Yeah,
you know? Everybody's waiting to see him after the band game.
Right. So we never got to see him. What a shame.
We played the channel twice, right, didn't you?
Yeah, it did. James Brown played on, like I said, January 17th. He also played, that was 1987, what you played. He played earlier. I've got to look through my sheet now.
Yeah, I think it was like 82 or 83. It was early on.
82 or 83.
I remember seeing it, yeah. But, of course, James Brown's tie into Boston was legendary, right? After the MLK assassination that day, he played the Boston Garden.
Now, James Brown played 84.
84, okay.
And it was March 23rd, 21.
But he played the Garden after the Martin Luther King assassination that day.
That night?
To quell the problems and the riots.
Wow.
He was supposed to play the Garden.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the mayor made a deal with him and paid him and paid the bill for two shows to broadcast it live on PBS that night.
Wow.
So it went out live. The whole concert went out live to keep people
off
the streets and rioting and try to keep people home.
Yeah.
And that show, if you get a chance to see it, is probably the best videotaped James Brown show you'll ever see.
Yeah.
We used to watch it on the bus when I was touring. We used to pull that out late at night. It's a killer.
Killer show.
Killer show. Non-stop.
I first saw James, I'd loved him when I was doing the Mojo Club and one of it, but it was Fleetwood Mac in San Francisco. We had a night off at the Fillmore West, and James was playing in town. So the boys wanted to go. We got tickets because we with Bill Graham, got us the fifth row in there. I'm sat in there watching this incredible show. Peter and John are going nuts. And Mick, Mick's eyes is like, I've never seen him so out of it because of the music and the way the performance was. It's the cape business that got Mick.
When
James came on at the end with the cape and he came off and he got up. It was just so good, but really dramatic, because he's not only playing, he's not just playing to a black crowd, it's all white kids having a great old time. Yeah. And he's like, wow, you know? This is 1968 or 69, one of them.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Oh, yeah, he was a legendary. I mean, what a showman. Everybody copied. And there's a great movie on the West Coast that he made for movie theaters, early 60s. I'm trying to remember the name of it now.
That was not the Tammy?
Yeah, Tammy Show.
Oh,
T-A-M-I.
Yeah.
With legendary bands.
Yeah.
I mean, the Stones are on.
Richard Pryor, I think, is in that.
Jan and Dean, the Beach Boys, Jerry and the Pacemakers. I think the Beatles are the only one who didn't do it because they weren't available. But one of the coolest pieces of the thing and one of the most weird things to watch is the James Brown set and the Stones follow James Brown.
How do you do that?
And you watch James do the whole cape routine, crawling off and all the dance moves, and Jagger walks on and does exactly the same move as James Brown.
Oh, wow.
He just lifted them all. And Michael Jackson lifted a lot of his moves from James. The other cool James Brown story is the pointing, and I didn't know about that until a few years ago. When you watch any of the videos, when he first hits the stage and starts, you'll see him point at the musicians and point at the shoes and the jackets and the shirts and hold his hand up in a five or two hands for tens. That was his fining system.
Yeah, yeah.
If the guys weren't dressed out right, he was such a disciplinarian to keep the show tight. He'd wait till he hit the stage and then look at you. And if your shoes weren't right, he'd point at your shoes and flash up 10. That was $10 he was taking out.
That's crazy. That's great.
He was a real
piece of work. And that scene followed that kind of stuff going on. They all go into that with these bands and stuff.
Yeah.
And you mess up, you get fined. Chuck Berry was a fun one.
Chuck Berry was notorious. And he was I'd looked that up, and I do know he played the Channel, and we can't see it, but he was scheduled for the Opera House, and it was a Channel show, and I think they moved it.
Chuck Berry?
Yeah, and I think that's it, because I know Tommy Hambridge had opened for him.
Well, he was another one, wasn't he, where I remember one time, I think it was me, where I reviewed a tent show and complained about the sound. And one of the sound guys from the tent called me up, and he said, Chuck Berry wouldn't do a sound check.
No, never.
It wasn't the sound of the tent. No. It was the fact that we didn't do that. We couldn't do that. And it was like, that was an eye opener.
No, he never did. His deals with the clubs were you had to provide the backup band. You didn't travel with a band.
Yeah.
You had to put the band in, and they had to know the material.
Yeah.
And they had to be good enough to play for him.
Yeah.
And if they weren't, he would fine the club or whoever was paying him an extra $1,000 for not giving him a good enough band.
Yeah.
But what he would do is walk on stage, you'd have his gear set up, walk on stage with his back to the band.
Yeah.
And start playing in a different key than they learned in or whatever.
Gosh, yeah. Just so to he check could get them out. The extra $1,000?
Well, not, partly that, but to see if they could follow him, to see if they were any good.
Interesting. Well,
my Chuck Berry story is at a place in Germany when I was doing shows with the Birds. Chuck and the Birds on this called Total Action Now, this giant festival in Munich, I think it was. Anyway, Chuck was supposed to go on. All of a sudden, you see Chuck at the top of the 20,000 plus seater, not seater, but arena, whatever it was, walking round the top doing his duck walk.
My ding-a-ling.
He didn't want to play until he got paid. We saw all these people out there. He wanted double his money. So he wouldn't go on, and there's no time when I'm out.
Well, he had the audience because he was counting the seats.
That's exactly. Exactly. And anyway, he goes this, that, and the other. The next thing you know, he's back on stage, and there's a guy giving him cash in the back. You can see that going on. As soon as he got his cash put in his pocket, ding-a-ling went out front.
Yeah, my ding-a-ling.
And that's it. And the band just took off with him. Yeah. Whatever he set up with the band, he just took off. A wonderful show. And then the time after that was, before that was the first time I was in Royal Albert Hall in England. And I came down the night before Fleetwood Mac and Peter Green played with B.B. King in the Albert Hall. We came down because the Who were there with Chuck Berry. Now, the thing was is that Chuck went on with all the rockers and stuff, and the rockers are going nuts and nuts and nuts. The next thing we know, they're off. He comes off the stage. He's had enough. He didn't want to do an encore. Yeah. That's his game. Didn't want to do an encore. Keep him holding. I don't think. The next thing you know, there's a bunch of Teddy Boys freaking out. And I says, oh, this is going to get weird. So I was with Bobby Pridden from The Who and stuff. And Bobby says, well, let's go. I'll give you a hand to change the gear. Let's get the gear changed and get The Who on. So we did the change, and next thing we did, Townsend and them came on and started this. The next thing, the rockers came up off the down below and started beating on The Who on stage. Gosh. We wanted Chuck. We've Chuck, Chuck,
yeah,
Chuck.
Yeah.
So there's a big brawl going on with those roadies banging people and stuff like that. And then Chuck came out just to calm people down, but The Who then took off with My Generation. So it was a cross between the rock and rollers and the mods in the Albert Hall. The cops couldn't do anything
about
it.
What year was this?
69.
Yeah, but all through, you know, the late 50s were the rockers, the motorbike guys in England.
Oh, yeah.
So they'd followed all the 50s rock and rollers.
Right.
Jerry Lee, Chuck Berry, Eddie Cochran, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So the mods were like early 60s.
Yeah,
and The Who broke out, and The Kinks, and The Small Faces.
And
so anytime you got right through the early 70s, anytime you got anywhere, there was the potential.
I didn't realize that it lasted that long. I thought that was more early 60s, mid 60s phenomenon.
What broke it was a lot of the mods, when the music started to change, late 60s, and reggae started to hit, and ska, a lot of the mods became skinheads.
Yeah.
And the skinhead movement was based on skinheads were a reggae thing.
Yeah.
And it was a fashion thing. Wasn't anything you know here as skinheads at that time.
Yeah.
The original skinheads were just like mods with really short hair.
Yeah, real short hair.
That's amazing. Wrangler jeans. I never would have guessed that.
They started wearing Doc Martens boots.
Yeah.
Because they were cheap.
Yeah.
Then they had their hair shaved real short. And a lot of them were the soccer supporters.
No.
That's
where
that's where
the violence came from. There was a lot of fight.
Hooligans.
And that's where it all changed. But the original skinhead thing was spawned from ska and reggae, and a lot of it out of Birmingham.
Why?
That's where the General Public and all those bands, UB40, all came out of that thing. But it was that's what kind of dissolved the mods and rockers.
So John,
the skinheads. Became skinheads and hippies.
When did you come out of Ireland?
So, when come out here?
No, when did you came out of Ireland to go down to England to do?
Oh, okay, yeah. So I left Dublin in '69, and so I went to London and hung around the clubs and started playing with some kind of smaller bands, you know, it was just in the pubs, you know.
Yeah.
It was hard, it was hard to get into the other places. Except I did, the 100 Club down on Oxford Street.
Nice.
Yeah, I did a few down there. And then I got, back then, like a lot of the English bands to be playing on the continent in Europe, you know. So I ended up getting in with a band who got a gig with Club Med, and we went to Italy for about 8 or 9 months. It was great. It was like
fun stuff.
Solid gig.
Yeah.
You know, solid money every week. Yeah, you know, it was really cool like that, you know. And then I came back and when I came back from that, remember, the Melody Maker had ads every week, you know.
Aye.
And you, I used to answer the ads, you know. So, this week, I just, I had to show, it didn't say anything, but, so I showed up for the audition. And It was Mark Bolan and T-Rex, right? So I had no clue till I got there. And so I freaked out. I mean, I walked and, they had the hit with, what was it, Ride a White Swan, I think it was, at the time. That was their hit. So they were trying to put a band together. You know?
That was the first show I saw.
Yeah.
Was so it the weekend it was released?
I went in and the two of them are just sitting there. And he says, okay, we're just going to jam. You know, so the conga player, So we jammed for about, it must have been about 20 minutes, 25 minutes. It was a long time.
Right.
I'm thinking to myself, this is good. You know, I went beyond 3 minutes. So, but eventually I didn't get it. A guy from the north of Ireland got it. I can't remember his name. But I think he ended up with...
He ended up with Tony Newman.
Yeah, and, or he ended up with Paul McCartney.
Yeah, and Tony was with... Bowie for a while and ended up with Bolan with that band.
Right.
And then again, I ended up seeing Tony Newman with the Everly Brothers.
Oh, really?
Was that with Albert Lee?
With Albert Lee, Tony Newman, and McCartney's keyboard player.
Yeah,
super little band.
Yeah.
Tony still up. He still works over here.
So how did he get, then you got a thing to come to Berkeley?
So what happened was, after I did a couple of, we were going around Europe for about a year, so I came back and I got a chance, I got a gig in Ireland with a band that was like, it was a band called Mushroom, and they had a record in Ireland, it was charting in Ireland at the time, and it was like, I think it was number 3. At the time I got the call, the drummer had gone to Switzerland for a ski holiday. Yeah, that's right, he broke his leg. So I helped on that one. And so I ended up coming back with them. And, and from that then, I got another gig with another band. And then, in the Melody Maker and some of the other mags, you'd see ads for Berkeley, and it was like, what's that? So it was like it was a curiosity factor. And I was really lucky because the band that I was playing with at the time was another band that charted in Ireland, But nonetheless, it meant that, I was making decent money, So it was like I'm looking at Berkeley and I'm saying because Dublin back then was 73, 74. Was a small pond, It was but I'm looking at Berkeley and I'm thinking to myself, Jesus, by this time I'd been working and I'd be getting good gigs and I was still very young. So I was thinking I'll go out there, do a semester, probably end up with somebody and then just start touring out there,
Good concept.
Especially when you're young. So I had enough money anyway. I made enough money to get a summer semester. So myself and the bass player in the band, we came out. And, when I did the summer semester, it was like, okay, now I know just how much that I don't know. So it was like, all right, I got to figure out a way how to, stay. And I want to go back for another one. So the only way to do it was to, do the Irish scene, because you could make steady money and you weren't going anywhere, you weren't traveling.
In the Boston market, right?
You were going out to work at night and coming back.
Still in Black Rose.
And then you go to school. There was no intrusion,
The fiddly diddly circuit.
So you played the fiddly, I diddly die. But it paid my way through, So... And then after I did the 2-year program, then a band at home, it was like Ireland's answer to the Average White Band or something. So it was like, okay, So I went back and I did that, and it was still like, I remember saying to them one time, we were coming back from a gig, and I said, we should be going to England. We should be at least doing a few gigs in England. I was like, dead silence. we're happy enough here with a few pints every night, you know. You know, what the hell do we want to be doing that for? You know, like, well, maybe we'll expand the band, you know. You know, we'd give it a shot, so...
That's the ambition, right?
Yeah,
now,
so it just wasn't there, you know. So then I said to myself, you know, come back out here. So I came back out here.
And that was 90?
Yeah.
1990?
That would have been around 1980.
Oh, okay.
So I came back out here. Yeah, I was doing like top 40 stuff. And then I got together with a couple of guys and we put Three Hands together.
You were doing cover stuff?
Yeah.
When you were back?
So that was like, it was making, you know, like you had to, you were trying to make, you know, a living.
I know. I saw your bio and I saw a band called The Preppies.
Oh, The Preppies. Jesus Christ. Did you see that?
Yeah, you have a credit on there on Discogs.
Holy Jesus. I got a call from this guy.
I'll buy The Preppies.
He says, I'm looking for somebody to do an album, you know. And it was like, so I said, yeah, okay, right, you know. He says, well, how much do you want? I said, well, how long are you going in the studio for? He says, a day to do an album. I said, 300. So he said, yeah, okay, fine. So I said, okay. So we went into downtown, you know, downtown in Boston. And we flew through, right? Boom, boom, boom. Yeah, that's great. That's him. Oh, yeah, that's good, that's good. Yeah. Well, what about that? No, it's okay, it's fine. So anyway, you know, I got paid at the end of the session. So it was like, so then the album came out, right? And he gave me a copy of the album. And he's on the cover of the album, right? Mm-hmm. And then on the back of the album is like, how you can make money if you sell this album. The pyramid scheme was, it's like graphically set out on the back.
Oh my God.
Right? And then, like, there's a little space with the songs. but like, two-thirds of the back of the album is like, if you sell three of these, that, and then your friends sell and he had little stick figures, you know.
That is so funny.
I got the thing and I just...
Do you still have it? Do you still have a copy of that?
No. I threw it away. I mean, I should have kept, but I was too young. I looked at it and I was disgusted.
Yeah, sure.
Jesus Christ, you know the way, like, when you're young, it's like, it's all about the music.
I'm a professional.
And I looked at this thing and I heard it. I mean, Jesus Christ, it's absolutely awful.
It's going for about $30 on Discogs.
I know.
Oh my God.
Could you imagine
what that would go for now?
He actually had the stick figures. You know, so how you could make if you sold the album.
I looked at it online.
I like that one. Cool.
I thought about it later. I mean, when you showed me the thing, I looked at it and I said, Jesus Christ. And then I said to myself, I wonder if he ever sold any. He mustn't
made
have,
somebody
because I never got a call back for the next album.
Oh my God.
So how did you come to start interacting with the channel? Was that
so
when you were doing original?
We started putting an original band
together?
With Three Hands, like we were three of us, none of us were from Boston, so we were like kind of against the wind on that aspect. But the other aspect back then was like, there was like clubs everywhere, you know. Clubs everywhere, you know. And the channel was probably, you know, next to the Paradise Memory, maybe, you know, that was the best place to play. So I bumped into you.
Yeah, that's where we met.
Yeah,
that was
1985. Yeah. And we'd had a song called What to Do. And then BCN had a local top 10,
yeah.
You know.
Excellent.
Yeah, so we managed to get to number one on that one.
Wow.
And so when that happened, then we started getting a couple of gigs.
When it started
channel,
to pick up.
Yeah,
like, had you been playing all the other places?
A Monday night at 6 o'clock,
right.
You know, and stuff like that, you know. And you'll work your
had
way
Had you been
up.
Doing the other ones? Had you been doing Chats and Jacks? And
Chats, yeah.
All those other little
Jumping
rooms.
Jack Flash down in Denmark.
That's right. That was another
one.
Bunratty's.
Jonathan Swift's.
Jonathan Swift's.
Yeah, and then there was the other one, Bunratty's.
Bunratty's.
Yeah.
All right.
And Storyville in Kenmore. And The Rat, of course. you know. And then when we got a bit of airplay, then we got a few gigs down at CBGB's. We were just going down to play for nothing, but
yeah.
It was just playing, trying to get the exposure, you know. But so we started playing the channel, and that was really cool.
I picked it up. That was pretty much the pattern then, wasn't it? You could get New York gigs.
Oh yeah, I mean,
would go,
you know,
for
like playing there was like, you know, it was great because. Especially if you got a weekend gig, you know.
Oh yeah.
You know, it was it was
weekend gig.
Even if you were first on, it didn't matter, you know.
No.
Like, you know.
Boston was hot. Boston was so alive then that even nationally everybody knew Boston bands were up and coming. It was it was sort of the
Cantones was another place that was down at the financial district.
MTV had kind of taken over everything nationally, but there was just still a scene.
I don't know, like
it was a homemade
scene. Back then you could, you know, there was a ton of bands, but there was a ton of gigs. So like, you could, if you got through on, you know, like ERS, you know, the radio station and stuff like that. You know, we ended up getting college, you know, airplay in college and stuff like that, and it was good. You know, it was like.
But you did the record in Ireland, right?
No, we did it here.
Oh,
we recorded
here?
Yeah, Deke used to come out here.
Oh, yeah, but you put it out on the label there.
And then he'd put it out on Scoff.
Which made it a little more interesting. Especially for the fans.
I always thought it was a smart move. There was a more interesting aspect to the thing, you know?
Scoff Records.
Yeah. So, but it, like, you know, the club scene back then was, like, totally different. You know, I mean, you know,
the number of bands, I mean, turning it over, you know,
and
you
the fact
said
that, like, you'd be playing, like, if you were headlining, you'd be playing at midnight, 1 o'clock, and you know, nowadays it's like 6, 7 to 9 or something, you know, if you do.
No, especially at the channel, because we did those local music nights Monday to Thursday, nearly every week, were 5 bands, right?
Yeah.
Was that the early show? And
we had we had the 2 o'clock license at the channel.
Oh, I see. So by the time you had the
8 o'clock,
band.
By the time you got the 5th band, they were going up at midnight
on an
early weeknight.
Mm.
And
that wasn't a great slot.
Right. Well, the way it kind of worked was it was loose. It was never that formal. But basically, if you did well and you brought people on one of those early weeknights and you did sort of 100 people, then you'd get the bottom slot on the Friday, Saturday night. And then if you did well there, you'd move up another slot for a national headline show. So that's how it works. So you got far enough to open for James Brown.
Yeah.
Got to see him walk past you.
What a contrast, what a musical contrast that was. Jesus. I remember, you know.
There were a lot of favours done in those days.
Oh, I was laughing my ass off and saying to myself, you know. But, what a band he had, man. Those guys.
Yeah.
Jesus, they were hot. They were really sharp.
Yeah, I think that was
remember, I saw a really good gig there with Charlie Watts' big band.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were talking about that a couple of weeks ago. That was a fantastic
band.
That
was interesting.
Yeah.
He had 2 drummers, I think.
And Jack Bruce was playing bass.
Was he playing bass in that band?
Really? Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Two drummers.
That was a great... They played the channel, so it was really
two
cool
drummers
because
you could stand
around close, you know, and watch it and stuff.
Yeah.
It was really...
I have that stage plot somewhere for that thing years on.
So Barry Marshall played just before you after Jim. It was you, The Clue. No, it was Barry Marshall and The Clue played after you.
Oh, wow.
After you.
Yeah.
On the James Brown night.
Oh,
so it was three bands.
A 3-band show.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, like I said, James wasn't in the building.
No, Jesus Christ, no.
That's so funny.
They said Kevin Almer was doing the DJing. Black Star Liner does the reggae and the world music. He told me, he says, you have to tell Tony, don't forget about the James Brown, all those hundreds of people outside when they all went on.
Yeah.
So when you went on to a lot of people.
Yes, yeah.
And then Barry went on to a lot of people, but there was hundreds of people still outside trying to get in and play this jam.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Kevin says he went out just to see, probably smoke something. and but came back in, and then this is, there's hundreds of people trying to get in this joint lineup. You could only get so many in.
Even if you're jammed. It was wedged.
What was capacity?
We saw a few of those nights. Well, I think the official was about 13.
Yeah.
Or 1350, I want to say.
Really?
But
That's pretty big.
I know we did the Gypsy Kings.
It's the biggest room in town for that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, biggest club in town.
Yeah.
Right.
Largest one because there was other rooms.
Yeah.
Like Bradford Ballroom, you could get a lot more in there. Yeah. And it changed over the years.
I don't think it had the same vibe, you know. The channel had a kind of a nice vibe to it.
See, that was the thing.
And you couldn't move around a lot. Cause
it was a big room, but it had a club.
Yeah, it was a club.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We were talking about that. I was a scene there that it kind of had a core following.